We're sitting here in the arena at KPH next to Mr. Raymond Smith, a veteran KPH operator on this day of days. Do you have a word for the audience, Ray?
Yes, it's certainly a pleasure to be here and hearing the remarkable fifth of Frank as he bids a fond farewell to all of his friends. He's working the Monterey on 16 makes there right now. Bill, I think it'd be a good idea if we recorded some of this fifth for posterity. I think at the first opportunity, you ought to get over there to position one and see if you can't capture some of that fine sending.
Thanks, Ray. And yes, we will do that. I should mention, though, that unfortunately the room is completely filled with photographers and newsmen and women at the moment. Flash bulbs are going off. People are running back and forth in confusion.
Outside, the mass multitude.
Supervisor Mary Geisel just walked by. Mary, do you have a word for the audience at this time? Some statement, perhaps?
Who's the audience?
Who is the audience? I can't say.
Well, I don't want to incriminate myself, but this way, this is what you speak into, huh? Well, let's see, what can I say? That I'm happy to be here with everyone. It's a great day, and I hope that I'll see many people this evening. Now,
thank you, Mary. I'm sure you will. Well, Mr. Geisel is now moving into the 500 position, and we are in for a big treat here. And I think we had better give Mr. Geisel a key, though.
Here, one on one ear, one on the other. One on your left is on the tuned antenna. Shall I mark it here? Bound for one.
Takes a while for these newer operators to get adjusted to their position. Fill in the log book, tune in the receivers, choose the antenna, plug in the bug. Sending.
Bill, you'll get a kick out of this. Visiting NPG, Bob Jones introduced us to the executive officer. Who says, "Hi, Dad." Not to me, but to him. So you can figure that he's, I think he said 42 years. I must be able to annoy somebody.
Well, Captain Lindquist doesn't get that message that's hanging up there in a few minutes. He's going to be after us. Very nice, Frank. I'm sure that this tape will be at least the equal of Dick Johnstone's famous SOS tape.
I haven't begun to fight yet.
Do you have any other statement on this memorable day at this time, or are you saving it up for tonight?
Actions speak louder than words.
Very fine. Thank you, Frank.
It's my medal. Well, if we were over our competitors, he'd be phoning the messages, he'd be on the teletype, something that's in a hurry here, Bill. Let me try my hand.
A little more speaker.
I want one that's easy to send.
Something anyway, perhaps a citation from the FCC. Mr. Geisel is flaunting his mastery of the German language before us here.
Put me on the printer because I wouldn't know what to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take a look at it.
Big dog, Mike, right?
Yeah, that's true. So I went for the silent period.
They just don't make them like this anymore.
Ask Mary if maybe this isn't a good thing. They don't make them like this.
Oh, we have our new manager of KPH, Mr. Hayton, here. I wonder if he has a word on this auspicious occasion.
I can't say very much. This is Frank's day.
Thanks, Bill. Geisel now takes over at position two.
I can't make out who it
amazing virtuosity now being displayed in copying through interference with a QSA-5 signal. Paul, when are you going to get caught up?
About a quarter to four, probably.
By the echo.
sending one to the SS Ventura on 22 megacycles.
We would like to thank William Brenneman, editor of the Sparks Journal of the Society of Wireless Pioneers, for the following article, entitled Richard Johnstone of Station KPH by Henry W. Dickow. Some of the old wire and wireless telegraphers were ambidextrous. They could telegraph with the right hand and write with a pencil held in the left. They could converse and telegraph at one and the same time. They could copy as fast as the stuff came over the wire or into their headphones. Richard Dick Johnstone of Station KPH near the San Francisco County line was one of them. His identification signal or sign was RJ. He was a phenomenon of the ether, one of the best telegraphers of the day. Station KPH was the goal, the promised land of scores of commercial telegraphers, but only a scant few of them ever reached this destination. Assignment to the station called for a better-than-average mastery of two codes, Morse for the landline and Continental for the wireless. Together with accuracy, reliability, patience, and a goodly measure of intestinal fortitude, or just plain guts. It was a nerve-wracking job. There were no idle moments during any 8-hour watch. Interference from other stations, commercial, Navy, Army, and particularly the amateurs, was terrific. To cope with the amateur problem required tact in the early days when there was no governmental regulations to restrain them. The air was free to all. Wavelengths were chosen at random, and the amount of power used for transmitting was determined by the financial status of the station operator and owner. Station KPH was ideally situated atop a high hill overlooking the Central Pacific Ocean. Because of its strategic location, it was often possible to make and break records for long-distance communication. Dick Johnstone served at KPH before and during World War I. He enlisted as a radio man in the U.S. Naval Reserve Force with the rating of chief electrician. In World War II, Johnstone served in the Navy, this time as a commander. While at KPH, one of his duties consisted of copying scores of position reports, or IRs, from ships at sea. Each night, beginning at 8 p.m., all ships within range would report their positions with respect to San Francisco or other major Pacific Coast ports, and then add a few words about the conditions of the weather. These reports would appear in the following morning in the marine news columns of the daily press. The practice has long since been discontinued, to the regret of many who followed the ship along the way. Dick Johnstone's popularity at KPH was a result of his personal acquaintance with the majority of seagoing operators and members of the local amateur fraternity. He knew most of them by the first name and could recognize them instantly by their fists, the manner in which they manipulated their telegraph keys. The operators on large passenger liners were usually better telegraphers than others. The freighter operators took life in stride, doing only what was necessary to earn their keep at the rate of $35 to $40 monthly. The tanker operators as a whole were a slow, sloppy style with a consistency of heavy oil which slushed about in the tanks far below them. Yet the operators aboard the freighters and tankers lived the good life. Sometimes they would send one message per day, sometimes none. Agonizing hours of duty came to KPH operators when the Japanese passenger liners, the Maru boats, were a few days out of San Francisco en route from the Orient. Each of these large ships carried hundreds of Japanese pitcher brides, young maidens who were to be joined in marriage to Japanese swans who met their intended wives through photographs mailed from the homeland, some which were not quite representative of what the prospective grooms had bargained for. And although the brides were usually chosen by their parents, the husbands were generally satisfied with their choices. On each voyage of a Maru boat, the ship's purser would engage the young brides-to-be to send a wireless message to their intended husbands. The text of these messages was always the same. Arrive Tuesday, meet ship. Nothing more, nothing less. The cost of such a message was exorbitant, $5. The brides were cajoled into sending them for fear that their intended husbands would not be on the docks to meet them when the steamer arrived. It was a racket and a shakedown, yet it continued through the long years from 1910 to 1916, when the Great War finally brought it to a halt. The $5 message fee was a split four ways. The ship's purser took the first dollar, the wireless operator a dollar, the chief operator at the home office 50 cents, and the remaining $2.50 went into the coffers of the Marconi company. Often 100 or more such messages came from each incoming ship, giving the wireless operator a lucrative stipend amounting to more than his entire salary for the voyage. When the ship arrived in port, the docks would swarm with great crowds of young Japanese men ready to greet their intended brides. It was a sight to behold, filled with pathos and humor. The men with wireless messages in hand, waving them frantically above their heads, would shout out the names of the girls. The sight was one like never seen before. The expressions on the faces of the little yellow men of Nippon and those of the chalk-white, black-haired, doll-like maidens in their colorful kimonos presented a kaleidoscope which, once seen, would never again be forgotten. Usually, the brides arrived flat broke, for the $5 fee extracted from them for the cost of the wireless message represented a considerable sum of money in those days, and all of their worldly possessions. At KPH, preparations were made in advance to receive the heavy volume of picture bride traffic. The text of the message was typed on stacks of Marconigrams. The number of the message, the check, that's the number of words, date, time of receipt, and the sign of the receiving operator were all entered in their proper places, requiring only the addition of the address and signature. These stacks of messages were laid alongside the mill, where the operator reached for them in numerical order. And after an hour or two, the final message would come in. During this interval, all other traffic on the air came to a halt. Once a Japanese liner began sending, he continued with his traffic until he had cleared his stack. In his biography, Dick Johnstone tells about the procedure. "Here comes one of my Japanese friends, Nakato, on the SS Nippon Maru." Maru means ship. He says, "Mushi, mushi, RJ, we have 70 messages from Pretty Picture Bride. You take, thank you, please, JNP. I answer, "Mato Ato Day," in Japanese, and he will wait my call. Some American ship breaks in and says, "What's going on?" Upon their arrival in San Francisco, the Japanese operators never failed to express their thanks and appreciation to Johnstone with personal calls and gifts of gold fountain pens. Unlike the bitter resentment displayed by the populace of San Francisco against the members of its local Japanese colony, there was a spirit of genuine camaraderie between the Oriental and American wireless operators. They, too, were brothers under the skin. The Japanese operators were crack calligraphers, all of them. They were given a far more intensive degree of training than the Americans. They first had to master their own Japanese code as well as the International Morse or Continental. They had to speak two languages, and the pay they received was a mere pittance, the equivalent of approximately $15 monthly. The call letters of all their ships began with the letter J. The operators told about the excitement that prevailed on the docks on steamer day when the picture brides disembarked. They told of how they hobbled into the arms of their lovers and how they traveled like cattle in steerage on a long voyage across the Pacific. Long forgotten are the days when the Tenyomaru, Shinyomaru, Nipponmaru, and others of the line let down their gangplanks and discharged their human cargoes. An astounding feat of long-distance communication never duplicated nor remotely approached is credited to Johnstone when he succeeded in working across the Pacific with a ship at anchor in Chinese waters and using only a crystal detector for the receiver at KPH. With nothing more than a tuning coil with a single layer of wire wound around a wooden core, a Glenna crystal detector, a tiny condenser, and a pair of headphones, Johnstone and Tom Lambert broke the world's record for long-distance communication with a crystal detector. Tom Lambert was the wireless operator aboard the Standard Oil tanker J.A. Moffat, call letters W.R.E., in 1915-16. She made a scheduled call at Richmond, California, to load a cargo of oil. She proceeded to Panama and then to China. While the ship was at Richmond, Lambert journeyed out to KPH at Hillcrest to arrange a test schedule with Johnstone. The purpose of the test was to determine the effective range of a crystal detector and a 1915 vintage wireless spark transmitter. Identical receivers were to be used aboard the Moffett and at KPH, with the exception that Lambert had a slightly better tuning device, known as a loose coupler, which replaced the older tuning coil. Arrangements were made between Johnstone and Lambert to send a dot, one single dot, each morning at 2:30. Reception of the dot would be acknowledged first by the Moffett, followed by her position report to KPH. It would have been much easier to send out a long call, but the test was previously made as difficult as possible by mutual agreement. Amazingly, the test was successful. The single dot was heard over a distance of more than 5,000 miles across the Pacific. Each morning, without exception, the Moffett heard the dot from KPH, and each morning she gave her position report as earlier agreed. To further complicate the test, Johnstone had agreed to acknowledge receipt of the position report with a single dot of his own, just as Lambert had done when he acknowledged the signal from KPH. The dots came through with amazing clearness and distinction for the first 4,000 miles, when static interference was encountered and additional annoyance of signal fading began. In spite of these obstacles, Johnston received the signals by standing on his toes, slightly pressing the headphones to his ears, holding his breath to memorize the position report from the Moffett. Following this awful suspense, Johnstone would acknowledge this message with a single dot. This all-time record kept the ship in communication with KPH for almost an entire month, although on her voyage home, the signals from the Moffett were not heard until she first reached a point 3,800 miles from San Francisco. No plausible explanation has ever been advanced for the success of this strange undertaking. It had not been done before and has never been done since under like conditions and circumstances. There have been other record-breaking contacts between KPH and ships at sea, but they were not achieved with Glenia crystals and tuning coils. The late A.W. Peterson, who sent press nightly from KPH, once worked a distance of 6,000 miles with the old rotary spark gap then used at Hillcrest. This record was established with the SS Floridian, WLR, while the vessel was Australia-bound. But she had aboard a more modern wireless spark transmitter of the quenched type, and most of all an Audion tube receiver. In modern times, these distances are commonplace at almost any hour of the day or night with the newer high-powered vacuum tube transmitters. But Johnstone, Lambert, and Peterson did their work with the spark. Johnstone did not see Lambert again. He left to accept an assignment with the movie colony in Hollywood, and there he died. But a year earlier, he verified in writing the success of the Trans-Pacific record-breaking feat, and Johnstone wrote and quizzed him on this score. Wrote Lambert, "Sure, we cleared over 5,000 miles, and I remember that old dot, the letter E. When I wanted you to give one dot, you would give me back one dot, and another dot when you okayed the message. If I remember, we cleared each other from the harbor in Panama, and then when laying off the Yangtze River in China. And no transmitters or amplifiers. Signed, Tom Lambert." Another innovation by Johnstone was his adaptation of the first one-wire aerial ever used on shipboard on the Pacific coast. For years earlier, ships were equipped with four-wire aerials and fitted with large, cumbersome insulators that required periodic cleaning to remove the soot and salt spray, which reduced their insulating properties. It was always a messy job to lower the antenna on shipboard, especially when the ship had more than two masts, for under these conditions, the aerial wires would become entangled with almost everything above deck. It was a laborious job to unsnarl them. Sailing ships like the Barkatine E.R. Sterling and the Union Oil Tanker, the sailing ship Erskine M. Phelps, were especially hard to equip with aerials and even harder to service. Vaseline was smeared over the surface of aerial insulators to improve their qualities, an exhausting undertaking in the tropical heat where the insulators required additional attention. If not properly maintained, they would set fire to the ship's rigging or to the masts themselves. The powerful wireless spark transmitters of old were vicious offenders. Worst of all, electrical shocks would be experienced by those who came in contact with leaky insulators, such as the sailors who work high up in the yardarms. The ship's rigging, if metal cable were used, was likewise very vulnerable. So the thought occurred to Johnstone that perhaps a means could be devised to dispense with the cumbersome four-wire aerial and use a single wire instead. Wireless amateurs, the forerunners of many commercial operators, had considerable success with a single wire. They then discarded their birdcage aerials and other weird designs, such as a chicken step spreader and umbrellas, in favor of the simple lone wire. Why not a one-wire aerial for shipboard use, Johnstone asked himself. It might not be as good as a four-wire type, but it could prove satisfactory in an emergency. Single-wire antennas had proved themselves adequate as early as 1901, when Marconi used a kite-wire string for his aerial to receive signals from across the Atlantic. In San Francisco, amateurs used box kites flown from Twin Peaks in 1908, and to their surprise, they worked a station in Portland, Oregon, with only a 1-inch spark coil for a transmitter. Best of all, amateur stations on the East Coast were heard in San Francisco with this box kite aerial setup. Johnstone once experimented with a box kite flown from a ship on which he had served. The main aerial had been blown down in a storm. With the lead-in wire 300 feet long, communication was conducted over a distance of 1,200 miles in the Pacific, while the East Coast stations were clearly received. In 1924, Johnstone was attached to the Marconi Marine Department in San Francisco as district manager for RCA, equipping and serving several hundred ships arriving and departing from San Francisco. One day, a rush call came from Standard Oil at Richmond, California. One of its ships, the Colonel E.L. Drake, had lost its aerial. In another 2 hours, she must sail. It would take that long to reach Richmond from San Francisco, so Johnstone ordered a temporary one-wire aerial installed in place of the original four-wire type. The ship had three masts. With an inverted L bracket on the main mast, a heavy cable was carried through an insulator from stem to stern. The transmitter then was retuned, and the ship was able to communicate all the way up and down the coast without the slightest difficulty. This was the end of many four-wire aerials. Today, most ships use a single wire, but the Colonel E.L. Drake had led the way. Her wireless operator was Reuben H. Horn. Have you ever been seasick? Only then will you realize that life can be worse than death. Seasoned mariners have been known to give up the ghost or whatever their stomachs contain when caught in the teeth of a roaring gale, their ships bouncing around like corks. It happened to Dick Johnstone on his first trip to sea. Being a wireless operator, he could not give up regardless of his seasickness. He alone could send out a distress call for help if the occasion demanded. Johnstone served on the old coal burner Acapulco of the Pacific Mail Steamship Company. The very first ship on the Pacific coast to be equipped with a new type wireless transmitter called a 240 cycle spark set. The receiver used a Fleming valve with a magnetic detector in reserve. The Acapulco was the last passenger liner to sail out of San Francisco on August 23, 1912, with but a single wireless operator. On her first day out, the brand new Marconi equipment blew up, doing considerable damage to the ship's dynamo. For several days, she was without power for lights or the wireless. Oil lamps were brought into service. Being only a kid of 17, said Johnstone, I was blamed for the disaster. The captain insisted that I copy the nightly press, no matter how seasick I might be. He came into the wireless room with a bucket, which he tied between my legs. In this manner, I copied the press while seated before my receiver. To this day, I don't know how I survived that. Dick Johnstone's colleagues at KPH were men of great skill and ability. Frank Shaw was one of them, Pop Hyde another, also George Hubbard, Aaron Pratt, and A.W. Peterson, to name a few more. Frank Shaw was the second trick man, and his four-to-midnight watch was nerve-wracking. Like so many of his fellow operators, he was physically handicapped. One of his eyes failed to track with the other, a humorous but pathetic sight, a condition of which he was extremely conscious. For this reason, he worked at night. His affliction prevented him from copying traffic on the mill. He had to use a pencil instead. And with his long-handled stick, he wrote them down as fast as they came in. Each time he finished one message, he would throw it over his shoulder and onto the floor. But before doing so, he carefully numbered each message in proper sequence. Not until he finished his watch was he able to transfer his handwritten messages to the typewriter, thereby requiring him to remain at his station for several hours after his tour of duty had expired. It was amusing to see him on the floor, on hands and knees, searching for the messages and putting them in chronological order. When a message occupied more than one page, he found himself in real trouble. Shaw was a teetotaler. In his lunch kit, he always carried a bottle of Iron Brew, a mild soda pop drink of the day with a wild-sounding name. One day, the station operator spiked his brew with bourbon. Shaw passed out. He did not awaken until 10 a.m. the following morning, never knowing what he had consumed. Those who compounded the joke were compelled to stand his watch. Pop Hyde of KPH was a venerable old codger, liked by all. He bore a striking resemblance to the character on the Quaker Oats carton, with his long white hair and his patriotical manner. His qualifications as a telegrapher were uncanny. An old Morse code wireman, he was unexcelled. George S. Hubbard once spent an evening with Hyde at the station, all of the time engaging in conversation. At the same time, the stream of traffic was coming in from the Maru boats. Hyde paid little attention to the Japanese operator and continued conversing with Hubbard. Suddenly, his fingers came to life as he reached for the mill, and he furiously typed away one message after another, putting down on the typewriter what he had received and retained within his memory while conversing. "I have seen men copy behind," said Hubbard, "but never the likes of old Pop Hyde." Hyde, like other old telegraphers, was a problem drinker. His fellow operators called him a sincere, earnest, dedicated imbiber. "And in the long years that I knew him," said Hubbard, "I found him intoxicated but once. I arrived at the station and Pop was gone. I roamed the surrounding cow pasture and soon found him, sleeping serenely, his snowy locks resting on the trusty neck of a cow, which was also asleep in the meadow during the wee small hours of the morning." And so, recapturing the old days, the pioneering days of wireless, we can look back and see these pioneers, these men that struck new ground, literal new ground, for a service that we all take for granted. Every ship on the high seas is equipped with high technology gear. But the pioneering path made by these men is truly the real story behind wireless on land and sea. Thank you.